Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Today, we're bringing in State Senator Tony Huang to help unpack the complexities related to proposed massive health insurance rate hikes under consideration for 2023. We're going to tell you how, as ratepayers, you can step up and try to help stop or greatly reduce those increases. Then we're going to visit with Connecticut Voices for Children to talk about the 2022 State of Early Childhood that examines the accessibility, affordability, quality, and funding of Connecticut's early childhood system. And we'll close on a similar subject with End Hunger Connecticut, which just convened a roundtable of policymakers and experts discussing the future of the popular summer meals program and what's in store for kids in cafeterias all over the state in the coming school year. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. Naugatuck Valley Community College will hold an advanced manufacturing information session August 3rd at 5:30 at its Waterbury campus in Technology Hall. Learn more about the Advanced Manufacturing Technology Certificate Program, financial aid, scholarships, and options for utilizing the certificate credits toward an associate's degree or transfer to other colleges. Classes begin August 29th with a full and part-time options, and those who enroll full-time can earn a certificate in as little as a year. To sign up or for more information on Naugatuck Valley's manufacturing program, visit nv.edu/makeithere. So we are on with our state senator from the 28th district here in Connecticut, Tony Huang, a regular guest, great resource. Tony serves the 28th district that incorporates Easton, Fairfield, Newtown, Weston, and Westport, but he is also the ranking member on the Public Health Insurance and Real Estate, as well as the Planning and Development Committees, and along with other responsibilities at the state capitol. So he's our go-to guy as we are grappling with this, some say insane, others say irresponsible, many I words and other words beginning with other letters that folks are using to describe the proposed 2023 health insurance requested rate increases from a number of insurance companies that serve folks here in Connecticut. Similar increases to group health plans on the agenda with public hearings coming up, and even as recently as just a few minutes before we engaged in this call with Senator Huang, more information coming in from the state insurance office. So, Tony, welcome. Thank you again for jumping right in at this crucial moment to talk about this important thing and to help people learn about how they can step up and lend their voice to opposing these rate hikes if in fact their voices are heard.
Well, John, thank you so much. And I truly do love listening to the program. It's so appropriately titled For the People. And I've learned so much, even as a policymaker, from the various community advocates that share their thoughts. And one of which is what we're going to talk about, the unsustainable health insurance rate increases in Connecticut. It really is shocking that we are being now confronted again with double-digit health insurance rate requests to the Connecticut Insurance Department from these various insurance companies, 13 on an average. Yeah. They're proposing an average of over 20%. Of increase to your health insurance rates. We're talking about health insurance rates that have nearly increased on a multiple to nearly 100% in the last 15 years. It really is staggering and infuriating and frustrating. And most important of all, it is unaffordable for many of the people that are confronted with inflationary costs, taxes, COVID challenges in their businesses.
Sure, sure.
It really is adding insult to injury, and unfortunately, I'm unfortunate to say, it feels like deja vu all over again. People have seen this repeatedly, and people think they're immune to it because it just continually increases, but unfortunately, this in itself, at 20%, is absolutely shocking.
Well, somewhere a tsunami of public outrage expressed at the right time through the right channels has the best chance of having an effect. But what's important to note is that the highest rate increases are being requested by companies providing personal health insurance plans. There are similar rate increases, slightly less, being proposed for group health plans. And, you know, I know that we're going to talk about that this really, the scary part of this is after many years of seeing such great success with people engaging with health insurance plans to help protect themselves and our state and national economy, we now see the risk of many people abandoning health insurance plans due to the potential increased costs that they're going to have to bear. But first, it's really important to help define to people the role that you helped play in part in getting the public hearings better publicized and most available to those who would benefit most by speaking up.
Well, thank you. And let's begin by saying the Affordable Care Act, nearly over 10 years, a decade ago, promised affordable, accessible, and quality health care for everyone. But here we are a decade later, and that promise has really not been fulfilled. And even more troubling, the cost of health care insurance has skyrocketed, as we've seen. And the fact is that we truly don't understand the high cost of health care. But that being said, the overall affordability is really hitting people hard. And one of the challenges we have is we have a very unique system in Connecticut. We have the group plans if you're employed with Sikorsky or with Electric Boat or any of large corporations, then they are self-insured, even though it has Anthem, Cigna, or Aetna.
Yeah, they're administrators.
They are administered by the company and self-insured. And those policies are governed by federal regulations, and the State Department of Insurance does not regulate them. Mm-hmm. The proposal that's being offered right now covers individual, independent contractors, and small business health insurance plans. They account for nearly about 20-25% of the marketplace. Those are people that are independent contractors doing work or small businesses, and they have seen tremendous increases and really don't have a voice. And the insurance department reviews and approves these processes. It is very similar to the high rising and uncontrolled utility costs that we have, because it goes under the same review process. An agency approves, disapproves, or reduces that. So in this case, right now, we have a unique format that the insurance company makes a proposal. The insurance department will set up a panel of three or four individuals that will review the actuarial as well as the request demands of the insurance company. And then they make a decision. It is a review process, not a engaged question and answer and transparency, and more importantly, an accountability in justifying their request. For example, the insurance companies are saying that inflationary cost is a factor of the cost increase. Another factor they said was COVID health costs. But when I think about that, John, I think about when people impacted by the restrictions of COVID really did not utilize a lot of the health care claims. So they probably didn't have as much claim challenges. So where is that increase? But unfortunately, the current process does not afford the general public and individuals like you or me to challenge these insurers to justify and account for those requests. I have asked the commissioner, along with many other advocates, Democrat and Republican, as well as public advocates in this area, to say this process needs to be an exchange of question and answer and a demanding of greater transparency and accountability. Unfortunately, I think the commissioner is still stuck in his old processes, and I hope that will change as we lead up to the public hearing.
So, but one so to, let me, Tony. Let me just insert here. So it wouldn't be a matter of a legislative edict that could potentially make the change in this process, or as you mentioned, the public utility rate increase process. Different. It is borne. The responsibility is borne by the commissioner, in this case of the Department of Insurance.
Absolutely. In the rate review process, yes. What we can do as policymakers is to take a look at some of the factors of cost, and we did try to do that. And in regards to prescription drugs, in regards to co-insurance, benchmarking, data tracking, those are things that we could be doing to be able to lower the cost of the entire healthcare ecosystem, tort litigation. Those are things that we can to reduce the overall cost. But in this case in point, only the insurance department makes the final decision in regards to whether to approve, reject, or reduce these rate increases. Now, I'm happy to report that on August 15th, there will be a public hearing. And in the past, John, it was held at the insurance department offices, which is in an office building, very difficult to get access.
Yeah, nearly unreachable.
Very little transparency.
Yep.
And we had requested for it to be moved to a public venue. And I'm grateful to hear that the commissioner has agreed. We are moving the meeting to the legislative office building on the state capitol with technology and public access. And they have made the hearings available via submitted testimony and submitted requests to appear via Zoom or MS Team on video so people can have their voices be heard. I can assure you, John, I will be there to offer and ask for challenges and rebuttal to the justification of these unsustainable rate increases, because I truly believe that we can't afford to impact hardworking people already impacted by inflation, by taxes, by the challenges of COVID. It really is an exponential insult to injury on the affordability that people are struggling with up and down Main Street.
So
and
the
hardest thing is,
oh, go ahead.
These utilities, these big corporations seem to be, in essence, representing Wall Street rather than the people up and down Main Street.
Okay. In the last 4 or 5 minutes that we have with you, Senator Huang, just one of the questions that just came up as we were looking across the data and prepping for this show is that the notification from the state said that public comment can be received 30 days or more after July 8th, which makes us think that, you know, around August 8th is the latest. But why do they say 30 days or more? Does that mean that that people who may have been on vacation and they find out about this late, but they still want to make a comment and advocate against the price hikes might have more time?
Again, John, another example of a lack of respect for transparency, accountability. And I can allay that for people. I will ask for people to submit their testimonies whenever they get to before the August 15th date. And I will ask them to CC me on that. And I will personally hand deliver their comments in writing to the commissioner's office. So you just share with me something new on a restriction of timing. And to me, that's another example of barriers. To schedule a meeting on August 15th in the middle of the summer is another example of business as usual on an inside track, in my opinion.
Sure.
So again, I will be putting onto my website all the links and information after this meeting by the end of day today that will have links to all the information they need to know, the request to be able to submit and talk on testimony, to submit their testimony in writing to the insurance department and CC me, and I will personally hand deliver it. Because to me, this impacts the very people who are not given an opportunity to be heard. And this has happened way too much. And as I said, deja vu, it's not being light in regards to that.
Of course.
It's people feeling as though the game is rigged against them and they have no other alternative and choice to be able to make sure that they are covering the health and well-being of themselves and their loved ones. And there is no negotiation on that. We have to be able to ensure that our loved ones and people around us get the necessary health care that's necessary. The bureaucracy should not be a reason why people do not have health care coverage. That's unacceptable to me at any turn. But this affordability is one where there's got to be greater transparency and accountability, because it cannot continue.
So you and Effect Center Wong have right now essentially been able to provide a de facto extension on the questionably closed ended deadline for people to file comments to be heard by this panel of insurance commission representatives from potentially the 8th to the 14th or even the morning of the 15th of August, which is awesome. As people are listening on Sunday morning or clicking on the podcast because they want to get the resource, where will they be able to go to get this sort of one-stop resource page with all the necessary click-throughs and information?
They can go to Senator Hwang, HWANG.com, and there'll be a link to that page, and on that page we'll have all the links to the insurance department, the rate request, what companies are requesting, links to the insurance department testimony, and the entire process. Again, Senator Hwang, HWANG.com. They can pop the article. All the links will be active. And again, I'll repeat, people who want to submit testimony, either written or verbal, send it. I will make sure it gets delivered on August 15th to the insurance department, and your voice will be heard. And if it's appropriate to be able to share on a program like this for the people, because it is such great programs like this that is a voice to let people know policies and issues that impact them. So I love being on it, and thank you for the incredible honor and privilege.
Oh, yeah, and people shouldn't worry about the quality of what they're saying. They could say something as simple as, like, if I have to pay this insurance increase, I'm not going to be able to get healthy groceries for my family. That can be one type of an example of a comment that somebody could file. But in the case of quality, it's not as important as quantity. It's the number of state residents who can step up and just paper this hearing with opposition, who may be able to be the voice of all of the people of the state of Connecticut to be able to make these rate hikes either go away or potentially be reduced. So thank you for the role that you're playing, Senator Tony Hwang from the 28th Senatorial District here in Connecticut, ranking member of the Public Health Insurance and Real Estate and Planning and Development Committees, among others. Thank you so much for your time and resource this morning once again. Well, I'm so pleased after probably about a 5 or 6 year absence that I'm able to reconnect with Connecticut Voices for Children, who provides trusted quality research, recommendations, and advocacy to advance public policy and investments to improve the well-being of Connecticut's children and families, and specifically those that have been historically disadvantaged. I love the organization and the fact that they kind of refer to themselves as a think and do tank. I've never seen that used before, and it really does sum up fantastically why this organization has been such a critical resource to our listeners and the award-winning For the People going back now probably a quarter century or more. So pleased to make the acquaintance of a brand new friend at the organization. Lauren Ruth is on the phone with us. She's a research and policy fellow with with Connecticut Voices and the co-author of the 2022 State of Early Childhood Report. So we are seeing a lot of headlines that this report generated in just the past couple of weeks and pointing to some critical information about particularly marginalized and disadvantaged children's groups across Connecticut. And I'm eager to jump in and talk about this today and help our listeners understand what the issues are and mobilize them to help if they possibly can, Lauren. First of all, thank you so much for not only being part of the program, but being part of Connecticut Voices. I understand you're a former educator, a Yale grad, enjoyed public policy, and developed a passion for it. So as the co-author of the this year's annual installment of the State of Early Childhood, can you talk a little bit about what that report is and why early childhood is such a priority for the organization?
Sure. Thanks, John. So our State of Early Childhood report has been published regularly since 2003, and it examines the accessibility, affordability, quality, and funding of Connecticut's early childhood education and care system. So it's a priority for Connecticut Voices for Children, primarily because early childhood care and education has such significant impacts on child development. Children who attend high-quality early care programs really learn better social, behavioral, and language skills, and participation in these programs can boost kindergarten performance by up to half a year, particularly as it applies to pre-reading and pre-writing. It also improves kids' attention and self-regulation once they get into a classroom. And there's some longitudinal research that shows that these results may last into high school, since preschool attenders are more likely to graduate on time, more likely to enroll in honors courses, less likely to be retained in a grade, and less likely to be chronically absent. In particular, these gains are longer lasting for children of color, children who are learning English as a second language, immigrant children, and children from low-income households. But as an organization that focuses on economic justice, we also look at the early care and education system because of its impact on parents' abilities to work and its impact on the economy. So we know that childcare is critical for parents to be able to be physically present at work, but it also improves efficiency and their reliability during the workday. While childcare shortages impact the work of both mothers and fathers, they're particularly hard on mothers, due to the continued norm of women being primary caretakers in heteronormative families. Mm-hmm. So during the pandemic, nearly 2.3 million women left the national workforce, which dropped the female labor participation rate to 57%. And looking at this in our state, Connecticut's female labor force participation rate has only risen back up to 59.5% compared to the pre-pandemic rate of 61.2%.
So about halfway.
About halfway. And in addition to the early care sector supporting parents being able to work, it's an entire industry and a profitable industry, well, profitable for the state industry in its own right. So according to the Committee of Economic Development, as of 2019, the child care industry in Connecticut generated an estimated $1.39 billion in revenue in Connecticut. It supported over 2,600 jobs, and it generated over $577 million in earnings.
But Lauren, we're still hearing so many statistics, not just here in Connecticut and across the country, of how the drop-off in availability of early childhood care has had ripple effects across the many economic situations and the areas that you just kind of covered. While it is a good business to be in as businesses go, certainly supply demand is still far exceeding supply. The pandemic did us no good in terms of sustaining still limited availability, and it cannot be sold short how critical the availability of child care for all is to the overall economic health of our neighborhoods, our cities, and our state and country. So that being said, how bad did it get during the pandemic, and how well is Connecticut doing in recovering from the impact of COVID-19 on accessibility to early childcare?
Whew, that is a packed question. So as you said, the pandemic really impacted the early care industry. And a large reason is that early care providers really run on razor-thin margins. And so a couple months of shutdown forced a lot of programs to have to close because they didn't have a couple months of money sitting around to keep their programs viable being able to receive clients. Mm-hmm. So Connecticut has seen a decrease in the number of family child care homes and in child care centers. Child care homes are ones run out of private homes, and child care centers are these larger providers that can care for double digits of children at one time. Mm. So between 2021 and 2022, Connecticut saw the number of licensed centers decrease by 173 centers, which is 12.4%. And that's a continuation of a decline that began with the pandemic. And the number of licensed family child care homes decreased by 20 homes, or 1%, between 2021 and 2022. Mm. But this continues a steady decline of 44% that we began tracking in 2002.
I was going to say, to their credit, Connecticut's Office of Early Childhood and government leaders did see this problem rolling out in real time. Mm-hmm. And they did admirable, some say, exhibited leading practices across the nation in trying to mitigate the premature closure of a lot of early childhood care providers, right?
Yeah. So the Office of Early Childhood has made numerous investments to stabilize the early care industry. So over $240 million has already been rolled out to the early care industry, including over $111 million in stabilization grants for child care programs. They've also helped families access needed technology to continue education. They've waived care for kids' parent fees and family fees at state-funded programs, provided summer funding for family resource centers and Head Start, helped stabilize college early care educator teacher programs, and expanded care for kids access by increasing eligibility limits, delaying the waitlist, and creating new eligibility groups. But given how expensive it is to run a high-quality program, many accredited programs and Head Start programs haven't been able to survive, and many large child care centers that were forced to close at the beginning of the pandemic didn't reopen. So to help people understand why this is, our 2021 State of Early Childhood examines the cost of running an early childhood care and education center. And we modeled the minimum cost of running a center, so not even a high-quality center, the bare minimum cost, mm-hmm. And found that if all families were using care for kids subsidies, the center would have had a 30% revenue gap. And so in order just to break even, centers would have to charge an average tuition over and above care for kids of $6,180 per child per year, just to break even. Mm. So even amongst those programs that have reopened, they've been frequently needed to close their doors due to teachers getting sick or children being exposed or sick. And these closures place burdens on both the programs and the families.
We're going to take a quick break and be back with our guest from Connecticut Voices for Children. Stay with us. Hey, do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. You heard about it first here on the award-winning For the People. Whether you like to run or walk, Homes for the Brave invites you to lace up and help veterans experiencing homelessness. The organization's signature fundraiser, Step Out for the Brave 40,000 Step Challenge, takes place from Saturday, August 6th through Sunday, August 14th. Every night, approximately 40,000 veterans are homeless across our country. And for just $40, this fundraiser allows participants to take their steps wherever they are during that 9-day period. All ages are welcome, and each participant will receive a Dry Fit event shirt. So if you'd like more information, just go to homesforthebrave.org/stepout2022. We're back with Lauren Ruth. She's a research and policy fellow with Connecticut Voices and Connecticut Voices for Children. Yeah, so in the best case scenario, we're probably looking at the average caregiver or parent having to make, in effect, almost an extra week's pay per month to just pay these early child care centers enough to break even. That is shocking.
And when you look at family childhood homes, it's even worse. Many of these FCCs out in the neighborhoods, you know, they're serving their neighbors. And so if a parent can't pay a co-pay, oftentimes the providers just suck it up and try to make it work. So our 2020 State of Early Childhood examined the cost of running a family child care home. And we estimated that a provider with one staff member would earn between $6.10 per hour and $8.64 per hour if they were only collecting care for kids.
Yeah, and at some point, and at some point the tank goes empty, and the health and wellness of either the provider or those in their care starts to become compromised or at least marginalized. This is such valuable and critically important information, and I'm so glad that Connecticut Voices for Children is bringing this out into the public, and it's being embraced in the media in such a big way. Hopefully folks are going to start getting an idea about this, particularly our state lawmakers who have the power to be able to affect some change. But we can't let you go, Lauren, without focusing in a little bit for the next 3 or 4 minutes on the needs of immigrants and refugees in Connecticut, because as we've been reporting on this program, they represent probably the largest sector of incoming new residents to the state of Connecticut over the past few years, or they're up there among the top members and new neighbors in our communities here across the state. In the last few minutes that we have with you, let's quickly take a turn of focus into the unusual burden that the immigrants and refugees face just in regards to early child care, never mind everything else.
Sure. So our report did both a quantitative and qualitative dig in to try and figure out how the needs of immigrant and refugee families might differ as they try and access the early care system. So I would encourage people listening, if they want to see the statistics on who the families are, to go to our paper. I'll just review some of our qualitative findings from interviews with families and with providers and with advocates who serve immigrant and refugee families. Families talked about information about early care and education not being readily available in their communities, and the enrollment process being really complex. So they talked about language barriers, regulations being complex, lack of knowledge about the system, fear and mistrust of government systems, and the need to complete multiple applications to try and access care, and that really contributed to them struggling. They also talked about language barriers making day-to-day communication between parents and providers excessively challenging. And so parents talked about how finding providers who speak their language is often one of their top priorities when trying to access child care. We also heard about a mismatch between care hours and work hours. Substantial portions of low-income Latinx and Black parents in Connecticut work hours outside of the 9-to-5 standard workday. And so these parents are forced to create complex combinations of early care systems, which tend to be less stable, and it may result in missed work hours. It can also result in additional costs every time a parent isn't able to pick up their child at the designated time. Providers can tack on costs to cover their staff time. Families talked about transportation really being a barrier. Our data showed that immigrant and refugee parents were less likely to have their own car and more likely to rely on shared forms of public transportation or walking. And because of this, distance can be a priority for parents. And, you know, if you miss a bus, then you've got that mismatch between care hours and work hours charge coming in. For immigrant and refugee community members who are interested in starting their own child care home, there were a lot of barriers, particularly navigating land use and zoning laws, created barriers to them being able to start businesses to serve their communities. And both the families and providers talked about discrimination being regular parts of their experience. So families talked about deficit-oriented thinking towards their children. Centers saying particular staff have to watch the immigrant children. And providers charging their families fees that they didn't charge to other families. The providers who were immigrants talked about the impact on their work hours, their access to benefit, and being told you have to care for specific children. You know, that's your thing to do now. We also heard a lot about remaining fears about ICE. Even though Connecticut is a sanctuary state and many of our cities have taken on sanctuary city status, parents want to know that when they drop off their child, at the end of the day, they'll be able to pick them up. So they want to know that ICE officers can't come into their child's place of education. They want to know that their information isn't being shared. And so this is information that the state could do a better job of helping parents understand and resonate with families.
Okay.
The last thing was need for space to support each other.
Say again?
The last thing was need for space to support and to help each other.
Okay. So in closing, it does sound like, the attack to put forward new policies does really need to start at the highest level of government. So the scenario is that here we are, January 2023, it's opening day of the Connecticut General Assembly. You have all the members of the Connecticut Senate and the Connecticut House all gathered for this big ceremonial opening day. And you are brought into the room and you're put up at the podium. If you had three things to ask of the Connecticut legislature to accomplish before the end of the 2023 session, what are those three things?
That is a great question. So one of our priorities at Connecticut Voices for Children is to try and move our state towards a system of universally accessible and affordable early childhood care and education. Ways to do this are to increase care for kids eligibility to all federally allowed families, to provide state funding to create a care for kids sister program for families that are excluded from care for kids due to their income or due to federal regulations, such as undocumented immigrant families cannot access care for kids, and to cap co-pays at no more than 7% for families so that they're not paying tons and tons of their income for early care. This would require the state to generate revenue that they designate specifically for early care and education in their statute and keep in a fund outside of the general fund. Our second policy would be to increase compensation for early care workers and ensure parity in compensation. So as we talked about, the pay for staff just isn't enough to be sustainable. But early care is essential infrastructure that allows families to work and supports Connecticut's entire economy. It's just not supported by the state and federal governments as essential infrastructure, despite being so. So we encourage state legislators to really prioritize both making care more accessible for families and making the pay more sustainable for providers. Furthermore, reimbursement for care at costs is higher than reimbursement for care at family child care homes. But the owners and staff at family child care homes are more likely to be women of color. So we see governmentally perpetuated racial inequities in this ECE reimbursement system, and we've been advocating for trying to get rid of those inequities. And then our third top priority would be to make the expanded federal CTC child tax credit permanent and to make Connecticut's one-time child tax rebate permanent. This year, Connecticut enacted a child tax rebate that families can apply for up until July 31st, so 10 more days.
Yeah.
And it's for $250 per child.
Oh, we've talked about it quite a bit on the program, actually.
Great. Great. So we found that looking at the expanded CTC, families in Connecticut overwhelmingly used that money for necessities. 51% for food, 28% for clothing, 25% for utilities, 20% for school books and supplies, and 13% for housing. And making the expanded federal CTC permanent and making Connecticut's one-time child tax rebate permanent would greatly help to offset these costs to families amidst rising inflation, amidst a still struggling to recover economy. Families, the one-time help is appreciated, but it's not enough. And in order to really prioritize children, both the federal government and the state government need to start raising children more affordable.
Good. A complicated conversation for early on a Sunday morning here in the middle of the summer, but worthy of revisiting. And we may, in fact, replay this segment a little bit closer to the opening of the legislature, Lauren, or circle back and talk with you or one of your research and policy colleagues again about this as we get closer to the commencement of the 2023 legislative session. Our guest, Lauren Ruth, is a research and policy fellow at Connecticut Voices for Children that work providing trusted quality research and recommendations and advocacy to advance public policy and investments to improve the well-being of Connecticut's children. Lots to think about. And if you'd like to learn more about this organization, how to support it, or to review the report and other important research that people like Lauren are doing, go to ctvoices.org. Lauren, thank you so much for your time this morning. We're pleased to be circling back with our friends from End Hunger Connecticut. They've been a guest on our program before. They are a statewide anti-hunger and food security organization focusing on advocacy, outreach, education, and research. They really serve as a comprehensive anti-hunger resource for policymakers, as well as community organizations and low-income families. One of their point people, Katie Pechkovsky, is with us this morning, and she is the right person to talk to because, as I just learned a few moments ago, she was not only a co-organizer, but also a co-host of a very exciting event that just happened back on July 15th. And although it happened in East Hartford, it has impact throughout the state of Connecticut and including the areas where our stations broadcast. So, Katie, welcome. Thanks for joining us. So did I miss anything in terms of what people need to know about what End Hunger Connecticut is all about?
So End Hunger Connecticut, we're a statewide anti-hunger organization, like you mentioned, and we do outreach and education and advocacy related to increasing access to food assistance programs, such as the SNAP program and the Free Summer Meals program.
And part of these, part of the discussion that occurred during this sort of roundtable event on July 15th incorporated that those two programs heavily, right?
Right. Yeah. So it's our work in the field of child nutrition that really inspired us to host this roundtable event. We've gotten a lot of questions from community members over the past few months about what will school and summer meals look like this summer and this coming school year. So we really felt it was important to bring together leading advocates and experts in the field together in one room to have a discussion about what have these programs looked like the past 2 years and what do we want them to look like in the future.
So in the opinion of your organization and Hunger Connecticut, how has Connecticut been doing? Because from a media source perspective, it has seemed often like Connecticut is among, if not a national leader on these fronts. And it's almost exciting to hear that there's still, some room to grow and be better.
Right. Yeah. No, I definitely have a great appreciation and admiration for all of the food service directors who've worked tirelessly over the past 2 years to navigate all the challenges of the pandemic and to continue to work to provide meals to thousands of kids throughout the state. During the pandemic, when everyone was going virtual, they were the frontline workers. They were still in the schools finding creative ways of getting meals out into the community, getting meals to kids and families. So I really have a great respect for the work they do and the challenges they still face. Mm. They're still encountering things like inflation and supply chain issues, staffing shortages. And those are things that we're seeing throughout the entire economy, but that's also impacting their work. So they're definitely, they're still out there advocating for kids and wanting to provide the best meals that they can to as many kids as possible.
Did the representatives at this roundtable, break things down to the extent where they might have been able to, offer some ideas about how they successfully improvise around shortcomings and supply chain issues?
Definitely. I think there have been waivers that have been put in place over the past 2 years that have been a really great help to these leaders. So that allowed for things like that increased their reimbursement rates for meals. It allowed for meal pattern flexibilities. During the pandemic, when things were at its worst, it allowed for things like grab-and-go meal options and multiple meal pickups. Parents could pick up meals at the time. So those flexibilities did allow them to, as you said, navigate those challenges and to figure out the best way of getting meals to kids in the state. And as we're moving into kind of a new phase in the pandemic and looking to the future, many of them were reflecting on the flexibilities that were in place over the past 2 years and commenting on how great they were and wanting them to continue for the school and summer ahead.
So who makes the decision that those flexible options may continue?
Yeah, so school and summer meals, those are federally funded programs. They're funded by the USDA, so the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And in Connecticut, they're state administered. So like the Summer Meals Program is administered by the Department of Education. And the Department of Education also regulates school meals as well. And as an organization, End Hunger Connecticut, we don't necessarily run the individual summer meal sites during the summer, mm-hmm. But we help the Department of Education promote the program. So it's changes that are going to happen in the program are going to happen on a federal level. As far as an organization and as a state, we have to comply with the federal rules and regulations that come from higher up.
One of the other things that we talk a lot about on this program, especially when it comes to young people in Connecticut, is nutrition. And this was also a key component of the planning and execution process for this roundtable. What can you tell folks in a quick minute or two about how parents and caregivers can look with some degree of excitement, enthusiasm toward the fall and back to school season, and the guidelines for both the healthy content and the attractability of the food that is going to be served in our school systems.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's definitely a growing movement to incorporate locally grown produce. We've seen that during summer programming, and we see that during the school year as school nutrition departments have created relationships with local growers to incorporate locally grown foods. They're definitely, school meals are not what they used to be. I know there's definitely been a stigma as to what they've been in the past, but there is a shift towards making them as most appealing and nutritious and exciting as possible, whether through like different themes, again, having these locally grown options. Just this summer, UConn Extension was hosting what they were calling the Dip into Summer Challenges at summer meal sites across the state. So those were opportunities to for summer meal sites to partner with local growers and to have kids sample fresh produce that they may not have tried before. So they were able to try dips made by the sponsors on site with these veggies and fruits, and again, have access to something that maybe they've never been encouraged to try before, and they had this opportunity.
Great. Well, as we are broadcasting this on the last day of July, is it still important to convey to listeners how they can find out about summer meal sites, or is the focus really quickly shifting toward back to school and where folks could go to learn more about supporting their own school district and its food service initiatives, especially for, families who need it most?
Yeah, it's definitely a little bit of both. There will be summer meal sites that are closing at the end of July, but there's many that are still operating throughout the state into August. So families can go to ctsummermeals.org, and that will bring them to a map that shows where all the summer meal sites are in the state of Connecticut. And if they put in their address and click on the pins that come up, that will bring up the meal site information from the address, the location, and hours of operation, as well as that end date for service.
Okay.
So it's important that families check to make sure that if their site is closing, that they find another site close to them. We're also encouraging families to look into completing their school meal applications for this coming school year. Many families haven't had to do that the past 2 years. So if you're confused about the process or if you have any questions, we encourage people to start doing that now. Another thing that we're encouraging families to do is to look into seeing if they're eligible for the SNAP program. Many families that don't realize that if your family is eligible for SNAP, your child is automatically enrolled in free and reduced school meals. So when you're completing that school meal application, you just check off a box, say that you're receiving SNAP, and it cuts down on that paperwork process.
And people can go to endhungerct.org for all that, the links and the reference material, correct?
Correct, yeah.
Good.
We have a statewide SNAP call center that assists with all things SNAP, from questions about the SNAP program to completing applications over the phone. And families can go, can actually call 1-866-974-7627. And that is our SNAP hotline number.
Very good. Katie Pichkovsky is with End Hunger Connecticut, recapping some of the high points of a recent roundtable that was held with statewide leaders back on July 15th. If you'd like more information, don't forget, if you want to find summer meals through August, ctsummermeals.org, or you can go to endhungerct.org for additional information, or also if you need to get oriented to the SNAP program, you're always welcome to get referred through InfoLine by just dialing 211.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.